Wallace that he wasn't giving any interviews. So it was a great surprise when he responded to my email. He was happy to be in touch, he wrote to me, and happy to chat on the phone or whatever. In the end, we arranged to go hiking in the Hollywood Hills. I flew to Los Angeles, even though his final email to me included an unexpected and unsettling sentence towards the end. I'm not sure I'm ready to be a case study or talk on the record. It seemed appropriate that we were hiking in a desert canyon because his punishment felt quite biblical, a public shaming followed by a casting out into the wilderness, although that analogy only went so far because biblical wildernesses tended not to be filled with extremely beautiful movie stars and models walking their dogs. We walked in silence for a while. Then Jonah listed two more reasons, alongside the Americans Want Tragedies with Happy Endings one, why I shouldn't write about him. First, if I was planning to be kind to him, he didn't deserve it. And second, a warning. What I mostly feel is intensely radioactive, so even people who come to me with good intentions, I end up transferring my isotopes onto them. Jonah was saying that spending time with him would ruin me in some unexpected way. Well, that's not going to happen to me, I laughed. Then you'll be the first, he said. As he said this, a bolt of panic shot into me. It was a frightening thing for someone to say. Still, I kept trying to convince him, on and on, but each line of reasoning seemed to make him more anguished, as if I was a siren trying to lure him to the rocks with my song of possible redemption. He said his worst days were when he allowed himself to hope for a second chance. The best were when he knew it was over forever and his destruction was necessary as a deterrent to others. I gave up. Jonah drove me back to my hotel. In the car, I stared at my lap, exhausted, like a cold caller after a long shift. Then, suddenly, Jonah said, I've decided to make a public apology. I looked up at him. Have you? Next week, Jonah said, in Miami, at a night lunch. The John S. and James L. Knight Foundation was created by the owners of the Chicago Daily News and the Miami Herald to fund young journalists with innovative ideas. There was to be a conference for the fund organisers, Jonah said, and he'd been asked to deliver the after-lunch keynote on the final day. Being advocates of digital media, their plan was to broadcast his speech live on their website. I keep writing and scrapping and rewriting it, Jonah said. Would you read it over? Maybe after that we can discuss whether I fit your narrative. I am the author of a book on creativity that is best known because it contains several fabricated Bob Dylan quotes. I committed plagiarism on my blog. I lied repeatedly to a journalist named Michael Moynihan to cover up the Dylan fabrications. I sat on the plane reading Jonah's apology speech. It was a stark opening, an unembellished declaration of guilt, followed by an account of his shame and regret. I think about all the readers I've disappointed, people who paid good money for my book and now don't want it on their shelves. I was surprised by his candour. Jonah had insisted on our hike that if he did decide to give me an interview, the one off-limit topic would be the shame. It was too private and personal, he said. But by the next sentence it became clear that the shame was something he intended to deal with as hurriedly as possible on the way to something else. This was, it quickly became clear, an apology speech like no other. He was going to explain his flaws within the context of neuroscience. It was a Jonah Lehrer keynote speech on the unique flaws of smart people like Jonah Lehrer. He began comparing himself to inadvertently imperfect scientists working at the FBI forensics lab. Innocent people had been convicted of terrorism because brilliant FBI scientists were victims of their hidden brain, undone by flaws so deep-seated they don't even notice their existence. He gave an example, an Oregon lawyer, Brandon Mayfield, who was falsely accused by the FBI of committing the Madrid bombings of March 2004. A fingerprint had been lifted from a bag of detonators found at the scene. After the FBI fed it into their database, Mayfield's name came back as a match. The detective soon discovered that Mayfield was a Muslim, married to an Egyptian immigrant, and had represented a convicted terrorist in a child custody dispute. The FBI held Mayfield for 2 weeks before acknowledging that the fingerprint match was actually not even close. In fact, the agency had fallen victim to a bias known as confirmation bias. It was only taking seriously pieces of information that confirmed its pre-existing belief that Mayfield was the culprit. It was unconsciously filtering out evidence that pointed to his innocence. As a result of the scandal, the FBI implemented rigorous new reforms to root out errors. "It would be great," Jonah's speech finished, "if something like that could happen with him. If I am lucky enough to write again, I won't write a thing that isn't fact-checked and fully footnoted. Because here is what I've learnt. Unless I'm willing to continually grapple with my failings, until I'm forced to fix my first draft and deal with criticism of the second and submit the final for a good independent scrubbing, I won't create anything worth keeping around." This was the happy ending Jonah believed Americans wanted. As I sat on the plane, I realised I had no idea if his speech was good or bad, if it would go down poorly or well. The FBI stuff was overly tangential and evasive. Jonah wasn't really like the FBI. As it happens, I've done my own research on the perils of confirmation bias and agree with Jonah that it is a powerful bias indeed, often found at the heart of miscarriages of justice. In fact, ever since I first learned about confirmation bias, I've been seeing it everywhere. Everywhere. But even a confirmation bias aficionado like me could see that Jonah hadn't succumbed to it. Deliberately padding out Bob Dylan quotes to fit a thesis about the creative process wasn't confirmation bias. So I found the FBI digression a bit slippery. But there was still a good chance that his speech could be like the end of Neil Diamond's The Jazz Singer, where the disgraced synagogue cantor wins over the congregation by reminding them how beautiful his singing voice is. I emailed Jonah to say I thought his speech was fantastic. He sent me an appreciative reply. I asked him if I could come with him to Miami. He said no. I am the author of a book on creativity that contains several fabricated Bob Dylan quotes. I lied to a journalist named Michael Moynihan. Jonah was at the Knight Foundation lectern, standing very still. I was watching at home on my computer. In his old lucrative public speaking days, his voice would rise and fall to emphasise this word or that, but now he sounded flat, like a scared child in front of the class. This was the most important speech of his life. He was begging for a second chance. As if things weren't stressful enough for him, the Knight Foundation had decided to erect a giant screen live Twitter feed behind his head. Anyone watching from home could tweet their ongoing opinion of Jonah's request for forgiveness using the hashtag InfoNeeds, and their comment would automatically appear in real time and in gigantic letters right next to Jonah's face. A second screen was positioned within his eyeline. I saw Jonah's eyes flicker to it. Wow! Jonah Lehrer talk dives directly into a listing of failures, errors and mea culpa. And that, people, is how you apologise. During the preceding 7 months, Jonah had been disgraced and ridiculed and cast out. He had shuffled the canyons of Los Angeles in a never-ending sweat of guilt and shame, a constant clenched pain. And now suddenly, there was light. I felt like I was witnessing a kind of miracle. Just like with my Spambot men, we knew when to shame and when to stop. It was like we instinctively understood that Jonah's punishment had reached an appropriate peak, and now it was time to listen to what he had to say. And then Jonah moved on to the FBI analogy. I'd like to tell you a story that has given me a little hope. It's a story about a mistake and how it was fixed. It's a story that I was working on at the time my career fell apart. The story is about forensic science. It quickly became extremely clear to Jonah, and to me watching at home, that the audience had no interest in his opinions on forensic science. Perhaps they would have at some point in his career, but not anymore. Jonah Lehrer boring people into forgiving him for his plagiarism. I'm not feeling terribly convinced by the deadpan mea culpa droning on by @JonahLehrer. I can't handle watching the Jonah Lehrer apology. He is boring and unconvincing. Time for something else. Jonah carried on. He talked of how, a month before he resigned from his job, he interviewed the behavioural economist Dan Ariely on the subject of how the human mind is a confabulation machine. The human mind is a confabulation machine. Now that's passing the buck. Using shoddy pop psych to explain inability to even write shoddy pop psych from scratch. Jonah Lehrer is a frigging sociopath. Trapped at the lectern, Jonah had 20 minutes of his speech to go, followed by the Q&A. I agreed with the tweeter who wrote that Jonah was passing the buck when he said that the human brain was a confabulation machine. But by mid-apology, it seemed irrelevant whether the criticisms had legitimacy. They were cascading into his eyeline in a torrent. Jonah was being told in the most visceral, instantaneous way that there was no forgiveness for him, no possibility of re-entry. The only way @JonahLehrer can redeem himself from his failures is by doing completely different work. He is tainted as a writer forever. I have zero inclination to forgive or read his future work. Rantings of a delusional, unrepentant narcissist. Jonah Lehrer's speech should be titled Recognising Self-Deluded Assholes and How to Avoid Them in the Future. Still, he was forced to continue. He had no choice. He had to reach the end. He flatly intoned that he hoped that one day, when I tell my young daughter the same story I've just told you, I will be a better person because of it, more humble. Wait, Jonah Lehrer is speaking at a journalism conference? Did they run out of people who aren't frauds with interesting stuff to say? Jonah Lehrer putting on a great demonstration of the emptiness of pop behaviour psych, a moral defective, tries to blame cognitive failure. He has not proven that he is capable of feeling shame. Power shifts fast. Jonah was being punished on Twitter because he was perceived to have misused his privilege. But he was on the floor then, and people were still kicking and congratulating themselves for punching up. The speech ended with a polite round of applause from the people in the same room as him. Amid the tidal wave of abuse, there had been some calls for humanity. A few tweeters noting the terrible strangeness of what was unfolding. Ah, Jonah Lehrer is apologising next to a live Twitter feed of people mocking him. It's basically a 21st century town square flogging. Jonah Lehrer is a real person. Twitter is making me so uncomfortable right now. Jonah Lehrer's crimes are significant, but apologising in front of a giant screen Twitter feed seems cruel and unusual punishment. But all that was wiped away when someone tweeted, "Did Lehrer get paid to be there today?" Of course he didn't, I thought. And then Knight answered that question. Jonah Lehrer was paid $20,000 to speak about plagiarism at the Knight lunch. Wish I could get paid $20,000 to say I'm a lying dirtbag. And so on, until late that evening, when finally, Journalism Foundation apologises for paying $20,000 to disgraced author Jonah Lehrer. Jonah emailed, "Today was really awful. I'm filled with all sorts of regret." I sent him a sympathetic reply. I said I thought he should donate the $20,000 to charity. "Nothing can turn this around," he replied. "I've got to be realistic about that. I shouldn't have accepted the invitation to speak, but now it's too late." Fuck off. You can't even do your apology without slotting it into some stupid Jonah framework, Michael Moynihan said to me over lunch at the cook shop in New York City. Michael shook his head in wonder. That wasn't an apology. It was a string of Gladwellian bullshit. He was on autopilot. He was a robot. Let me get this study from some academic. All the words he used to describe his dishonesty, it was like a thesaurus had landed on his head. Michael paused. "Oh," he said, "someone sent me a text. I thought he was reading way too much into it, but he pointed out to me that Jonah had said, 'I lied to a journalist called Michael Moynihan.' I love that." I said, "Yeah, I see what you're saying. He didn't lie to journalist Michael Moynihan. That's the great trick of the language. A journalist called Michael Moynihan. Who's this fucking schlub?" Michael took a bite of his steak. The fact was, his was a great scoop. It was great journalism. And what did Michael get from it? Some congratulatory tweets, which probably give you a bit of a dopamine rush or something, but otherwise, nothing. $2,200 plus a veiled insult from Jonah if Michael and his friend weren't being paranoid about that part. Michael shook his head. "Nothing came out of this for me," he said. In fact, it was worse than nothing. Michael had noticed that people were starting to feel scared of him. Fellow journalists. A few days before our lunch, some panicked writer, someone Michael barely knew, had confessed out of the blue that a biography he'd written might have inadvertently veered into plagiarism. "Like I adjudicate these things," said Michael. Whether Michael liked it or not, there was fear in the air now because of what had happened to Jonah. But Michael didn't want to be some witch-finder general roaming the countryside with writers blurting out declarations of guilt to him, begging his forgiveness for crimes he hadn't known they'd committed. "You turn around and you suddenly realise you're the head of a pitchfork mob," Michael said, "and it's, what are these people fucking doing here? Why are they acting like heathens? I don't want to be associated with this at all. I want to get out of here." "It was horrible," I said. All this time I'd been thinking we were in the middle of some kind of idealistic reimagining of the justice system, but those people were so cold. The response to Jonah's apology had been brutal and confusing to me. It felt like the people on Twitter had been invited to be characters in a courtroom drama and had been allowed to choose their roles and had all gone for the part of the hanging judge. It was even worse than that. They'd all gone for the part of the people in the lithographs being ribald at whippings. "I'm watching people stabbing and stabbing and stabbing Jonah," Michael said, "and he's dead." The next day I drove from New York to Boston to visit the Massachusetts Archives and the Massachusetts Historical Society. Given how vicious the resurgence of public shaming had suddenly turned, I wondered why that type of punishment had been phased out in the 19th century. I had assumed, as most people do, I think, that their demise was due to migration from the villages to the cities. Shame became ineffectual because a pilloried person could just lose themselves in the anonymous crowd as soon as the chastisement was over. Shame had lost its power to shame. That was my assumption. Was it right? I parked my car outside the Massachusetts Archive a slab-like brutalist building on the waterfront near the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library and Museum. Inside were the microfilms that preserve the earliest legal documents handwritten by the Puritan settlers. I took my seat at a microfilm reader and began to carefully scroll through them. For the first 100 years, as far as I could tell, all that happened in America was that various people called Nathaniel had purchased land near rivers. The spindly words swirled on the fraying pages. They really should have spent more time on paragraph breaks back then and less time on the letter F. I began to speed up, scrolling unprofessionally, decades passing before me in seconds, until I suddenly found myself face to face with an early American shaming. It was the 15th of July, 1742. A woman named Abigail Gilpin, her husband at sea, was found naked in bed with one John Russell. They were both to be whipped at the public whipping post, 20 stripes each. Abigail was appealing, not the whipping itself, but was begging the judge to let me have my punishment before the people are stirring. If your honour pleases, take some pity on me for my dear children who cannot help their mother's unfortunate failings. The documents don't reveal whether the judge consented, but straight after that I found a transcript of a sermon that offered a clue as to why she might have pleaded for a private whipping. The sermon, by the Reverend Nathan Strong of Hartford, Connecticut, was an entreaty to people to be less exuberant at executions. Do not go to that place of horror with elevated spirits and gay hearts, for death is there. Justice and judgment are there. The power of government, displayed in its most awful form, is there. The person who can go and look on death merely to gratify an idle humour is destitute both of humanity and piety. After lunch, I travelled the few miles to the Massachusetts Historical Society, a grand old townhouse on Boylston Street. I remembered something Jonah had emailed me before I flew to Los Angeles. The shaming process is fucking brutal. I thought about the phrase, shaming process. It was probably reassuring for a shamee to envisage their punishment as a process rather than a free-for-all. If you're being destroyed, you want to feel that the people tearing you apart at least know what they're doing. Well, maybe less delicate shamees wouldn't care how orderly their shaming was, but Jonah struck me as someone for whom structure was important and who had only ever wanted to impress people and fit in. It turned out that public shaming had once been a process. A book of Delawarean law I discovered at the Massachusetts Historical Society revealed that if Jonah had been found guilty of lying or publishing false news in the 1800s, he would have been fined, placed in the stocks for a period not exceeding 4 hours, or publicly whipped with not more than 40 stripes. If the judge had chosen a whipping, local newspapers would have published a digest detailing the amount of squirming that had occurred. Rashen Hayden squirmed considerably during the performance and their backs were well scarred, wrote the Delawarean of an 1876 whipping. If Jonah's whipper had been deemed to have not whipped hard enough, the reviews would have been scathing. Suppressed remarks were expressed by large numbers. Many were heard to say that the punishment was a farce. Drunken fights and rows followed in rapid succession, reported Delaware's Wilmington Daily Commercial after a disappointing 1873 whipping. The common assumption is that public punishments died out in the new great metropolises because they'd been judged useless. Everyone was too busy being industrious to bother to trail a transgressor through the city crowds. But at the archives, I found no evidence that public shaming fell out of fashion as a result of newfound anonymity. I did, however, find plenty of people from centuries past bemoaning its outsized cruelty, warning that well-meaning people in a crowd often take it too far. The movement against public shamings was already in full flow in March 1787 when Benjamin Rush, a United States founding father, wrote a paper calling for them to be outlawed. The stocks, the pillory, the whipping post, the lot. Ignominy being universally acknowledged to be a worse punishment than death. It would seem strange that ignominy should ever have been adopted as a milder punishment than death, did we not know that the human mind seldom arrives at truth upon any subject till it has first reached the extremity of error. In case you consider Rush to be too much of a bleeding-heart liberal, it's worth pointing out that his proposition for alternatives to public shaming included taking the criminal into a private room away from the public gaze and administering bodily pain. To ascertain the nature, degrees and duration of the bodily pain will require some knowledge of the principles of sensation and of the sympathies which occur in the nervous system. Benjamin Rush, An Inquiry into the Effects of Public Punishments Upon Criminals and Upon Society, 9th of March, 1787. Public punishments were abolished altogether within 50 years of Rush's paper, with only Delaware weirdly holding out until 1952, which is why the Delaware-located whipping critiques I excerpt above were published in the 1870s. The New York Times, baffled by Delaware's obstinacy, tried to argue them into change in an 1867 editorial. If it had previously existed in the convicted person's bosom a spark of self-respect, the exposure to public shame utterly extinguishes it. Without the hope that springs eternal in the human breast, without some desire to reform and become a good citizen, and the feeling that such a thing is possible, no criminal can ever return to honourable courses. A boy of 18 who is whipped at Newcastle, a Delaware whipping post, for larceny, is in 9 cases out of 10 ruined. With his self-respect destroyed, and the taunt and sneer of public disgrace branded upon his forehead, he feels himself lost and abandoned by his fellows. Quoted in Red Hannah, Delaware's Whipping Post, by Robert Graham Caldwell, University of Pennsylvania Press, Philadelphia, 1947. As Jonah Lehrer stood in front of that giant screen Twitter feed on the 12th of February 2013, he experienced something that had been widely considered appalling in the 18th century. I left the Massachusetts Historical Society, took out my phone and asked Twitter, "Has Twitter become a kangaroo court?" "Not a kangaroo court," someone replied quite tersely. "Twitter still can't impose real sentences, just commentary, only unlike you, John, we aren't paid for it." Was he right? It felt like a question that really needed to be answered, because it didn't seem to be crossing any of our minds to wonder whether whichever person we had just shamed was okay or in ruins. I suppose that when shamings are delivered like remotely administered drone strikes, nobody needs to think about how ferocious our collective power might be. The snowflake never needs to feel responsible for the avalanche. Lehrer's intention in submitting himself to a public grilling was to show the world that he's ready to return to journalism, that we can trust him because he knows now not to trust himself. All he proved is that he's not wired like the rest of us. If he can figure out why that is, it would be a neuroscience story worth publishing. Jeff Berkovici, Forbes magazine, 12th of February, 2013. I've been banging the drum for Lehrer to quiet his detractors and bank some goodwill by donating that $20,000 to charity. Finally, I managed to get him on the phone this afternoon. "I'm not interested in commenting," he told me. Could he at least say whether he planned to keep the money? "I read your article. I have nothing to say to you," he said before hanging up. Jeff Berkovici, Forbes magazine, 13th of February, 2013. I'm still not entirely sure what I can give you. Jonah's voice trailed off. He was talking to me down the phone from his home in Los Angeles. That $20,000, I said. It was absolutely a mistake, he said. I didn't ask for it. It was offered. They just gave it to me. I mean, what else do you want? Jonah paused. Look, I've got bills to pay. I haven't earned a penny in 7 months. I was flying high. I was making lots of money, and all of a sudden you're making no money. Jonah had finally agreed to a lengthier interview. He sounded exhausted, like he'd been inside some spinning machine designed by aliens to test the effects of stress on humans. For a smart man, everything he'd done from the moment Michael first emailed him had been a giant miscalculation. He'd been like a balloon becoming popped, shooting wildly in all directions, lying frantically to Michael, before slumping, the air all gone, in the middle of one of modern times' most terrible shamings. A friend forwarded me a blog post by Jerry Coyne from the University of Chicago, Jonah said. An eminent guy. I interviewed him on occasion. He wrote a blog post about me where he called me a sociopath. I sense that Lara is a bit of a sociopath. Yes, shows of contrition are often phony, meant to convince a gullible public, as in Lance Armstrong's case, that they're good to go again, but Lara can't even be bothered to fake an apology that sounds meaningful. Call me uncharitable, but if I were a magazine editor, I would never hire him. Jerry Coyne, quoted on richardboker.com, 18th of February, 2013. I thought of you, Jonah said. I thought, that's an interesting question for John. John spent some time with me. Maybe I am a sociopath. The question didn't surprise me. Ever since I published a book about psychopaths, people have been asking me if they're one, or if not them, their boss, or their ex-boyfriend, or Lance Armstrong. Perhaps Jonah was honestly intrigued by the possibility that he was one, but I didn't think so. I think he knew he wasn't, and he had a different reason for wanting to have this conversation. Academics shouldn't diagnose people from afar as sociopaths. It was a stupid thing for Jerry Coyne to have done. I think Jonah wanted us to bitch about his stupidity for a moment. It would be a way for him to recover some self-esteem, to do a bit of shaming of someone else. Jonah was at rock bottom, so I was happy to go along with it. I told Jonah that he didn't seem like someone who had no conscience. Who the hell knows what a conscience is? Jonah replied. If a conscience is living in a world defined by regrets, then, yeah, I've got a conscience. My very first thought every morning is what I've done wrong. That sounds self-pitying, and I'd like you not to use that quote, but there's no other way around it. If it felt really important to use that quote, could I? I asked him. Jonah sighed. I mean, it depends how you use it, but I prefer you not to use it, he replied. I did use the quote because it seemed important, given that so many people imagine Jonah has some neurological lack of conscience. Regrets of the sort I have are all-consuming, Jonah continued. I think about what I've done to the people I love, what I've put my wife through, what I've put my brother through, what I've put my parents through. That is haunting. Long after I get over the loss of my status and the loss of my career, which I enjoyed, I will never... Jonah trailed off. Life is short, and I've caused tremendous pain to the people I love. I don't know what that feeling's called. Remorse sounds about right. There's a tremendous amount of remorse, and as time passes, that isn't going away. It is miserable and haunting. I heard Jonah's baby daughter crying in the background. We talked about the slippery slope that led to the fake Dylan quotes. It began with the self-plagiarism, with Jonah reusing his own paragraphs in different stories. I told him I didn't consider that the crime of the century. Frank Sinatra doesn't only sing My Way once, I said. The self-plagiarism should have been a warning sign, Jonah said. It should have been a sign that I was stretched then. If I needed to recycle my own material, why was I bothering to write this blog post in the first place? Look, we can debate the ethics of it, and I've certainly heard lots of debate about this. But at the time, I didn't think it was wrong. If I'd thought it was wrong, I would have taken some trouble to hide my tracks. He paused. It should have been a huge flashing neon sign telling me you were getting careless. You're taking shortcuts and not noticing, and shortcuts become habits, and you excuse them because you're too busy. I wasn't turning anything down. What would have been wrong with turning things down? I asked. It was just some toxic mixture of insecurity and ambition, said Jonah. I always felt like a fad. I felt like I was going to be hot for a second, and then I would disappear, so I had to act while I could. And there was just some deep-seated, I sound like I'm on a couch with my shrink, some very dangerous and reckless ambition. You combine insecurity and ambition, and you get an inability to say no to things. And then one day you get an email saying there are these 4 Dylan quotes, it was 6 Dylan quotes, and they can't be explained, and they can't be found anywhere else, and you realise you made them up in your book proposal 3 years before, and you were too lazy, too stupid to ever check. I can only wish, and I wish this profoundly, I'd had the temerity, the courage to do a fact check on my last book. But as anyone who does a fact check knows, they're not particularly fun things to go through. Your story gets a little flatter. You're forced to grapple with all your mistakes, conscious and unconscious. So you forgot that the fake quotes were in the book, I asked. Forget gets me off the hook too easily, he replied. I didn't want to remember, so I made no effort to. I wrote well, so why check? So you were sloppy. I don't want to just blame sloppiness, he said. It was sloppiness and deception. Sloppiness and lies. I lied to cover up the sloppiness. I'd been thinking that when I told Jonah his speech was fantastic, it was probably a bad steer. In truth, I'd needed to read it 3 or 4 times on the plane because the words kept swirling around on the page, and I didn't know whether that was a reflection of attention deficiency on my part or abstruse phrasing on Jonah's. But like all journalists, I really love a scoop. A scoop keeps at bay the scream of failure, and I thought that telling him it was fantastic would be my best chance of winning the interview. I worked really hard on it, Jonah said. I was looking at that Twitter stream during it and the things people were saying. Some people saw the FBI analogies as the worst possible thing in the world, but that's not some deceptive trick. That's the way I make sense of the world. That's how I think. Clearly it was a mistake, but... He trailed off. That Twitter stream, I said. I was trying to apologise and see the response to it live. I didn't know if I was going to get through that. I had to turn off some emotional switch in me. I think I had to shut down. What are the tweets you remember most? It wasn't the totally off-the-wall cruel ones, because those are so easy to discount, he said. It's the ones that mixed in a little tenderness with the shiv. Like what? I don't want to... Jonah said he couldn't judge why people got so mad about his apology. I said I thought it was because it sounded too much like a Jonah Lehrer speech from the old days. People wanted to see him altered somehow. Not being overtly cowed gave the audience permission to envisage him dramatically, a monster immune to shame. They didn't want you to intellectualise it, I said. They wanted you to be emotional. If you'd be more emotional, they'd have gone for it more. Jonah sighed. That may have been a better strategy, he said, but it wasn't a strategy I wanted to rehearse on stage. It was not something I wanted to share with the universe, with everyone on Twitter. I didn't want to talk about how this had ruined me. That's something for me to deal with, and for my loved ones to help me through, but that's not something I wanted to get up on stage in front of the internet and talk about. Why not? I asked. Oh gosh, I don't know, said Jonah. Could you do that? Yes, I said. I think I could. And I think that would mean I'd survive better than you. So what would John Ronson's apology speech be? Jonah said. What would you say? Right, I said. I'd say... Okay, I... Hello, I'm John Ronson, and I want to apologise for... I trailed off. What would I say? I cleared my throat. I just want everyone to know that I'm really upset. Jonah was listening patiently down the line. I stopped. Even though I was just play-acting, I felt wiped out, and I hadn't really even got anywhere in my attempt. What happened to you is my worst nightmare, I said. Yeah, Jonah replied. It was mine too. 4 more months passed. The winter became the early summer. Then, unexpectedly, Andrew Wiley began shopping a new Jonah Lehrer book proposal around New York City's publishers. A book about love. The proposal was immediately leaked to the New York Times. In it, Jonah described the moment he felt the shiver of a voicemail message. I have been found out. I puke into a recycling bin. And then I start to cry. Why was I crying? I had been caught in a lie, a desperate attempt to conceal my mistakes. And now it was clear that within 24 hours, my fall would begin. I would lose my job and my reputation. My private shame would become public. Jonah left St. Louis and returned to Los Angeles, his suit and shirt stained with sweat and vomit. I open the front door and take off my dirty shirt and weep on the shoulder of my wife. My wife is caring but confused. How the hell could I be so reckless? I have no good answers. Jonah Lehrer's book proposal has leaked to the New York Times, 6th of June 2013. New York's media community declared itself resolutely indifferent to Jonah's suffering. Recycling bin is a hilarious choice of detail for the compulsive plagiarist, wrote Gawker's Tom Skoker. And obviously, bring us 2 witnesses who saw you puke, when and where you claim you puked, or don't bother. And then, to my amazement, Slate's Daniel Engber announced that he had spent a day combing through Jonah's proposal and believed he had uncovered plagiarism within it. Surely Jonah hadn't been that insanely reckless. On reading Engbar's article more closely, things didn't seem quite so clear-cut. A chapter on the secret to having a happy marriage, Engbar wrote, comes close to copying a recent essay on the same subject by Adam Gopnik, Lehrer's one-time colleague at The New Yorker. Gopnik. In 1838, when Darwin was first thinking of marriage, he made an irresistible series of notes on the subject, a scientific-seeming list of marriage pros and cons. In favour of marriage, he included the acquisition of a constant companion and friend in old age, and memorably and conclusively decided that a wife would be better than a dog anyhow. Lehrer. In July 1838, Charles Darwin considered the possibility of marriage in his scientific notebook. His thoughts quickly took the shape of a list, a balance sheet of reasons to marry and not marry. The pros of wedlock were straightforward. Darwin cited the possibility of children, if it please God, the health benefits of attachment, and the pleasure of having a constant companion and friend in old age. A wife, he wrote, was probably better than a dog anyhow. Gopnik. And the Darwins went on to have something close to an ideal marriage. Lehrer. This might seem like an inauspicious start to a relationship, but the Darwins went on to have a nearly ideal marriage. And so on, for a few paragraphs. Engbar wasn't totally sure this counted as plagiarism, or if he modified his words to stop just short of doing so. Or maybe both men had drawn from the same source. In the footnotes, Lehrer cites page 661 of Desmond and Moore's 1991 biography of Darwin. Anyone who has a copy of that book is invited to check the wordings, Engbar wrote. But even if it wasn't plagiarism, Engbar was convinced that Lera hasn't changed his ways at all. He's set in his course as clearly as can be. He'll recycle and repeat. He'll puke his gritty guts out. No matter what transgressions Jonah had or hadn't committed, it seemed to me, he couldn't win. But his book about love will be published by Simon & Schuster around the same time that this book will, so we'll all learn at once if it will win him some redemption. Chapter 4. God, that was awesome. During the months that followed, it became routine. Everyday people, some with young children, were getting annihilated for tweeting some badly worded joke to their 100 or so followers. I'd meet them in restaurants and airport cafes, spectral figures wandering the earth like the living dead in the business wear of their former lives. It was happening with such regularity, it didn't even seem coincidental that one of them, Justine Sacco, had been working in the same office building as Michael Moynihan until 3 weeks earlier when, passing through Heathrow Airport, she wrote a tweet that came out badly. It was 20th of December 2013. For the previous 2 days, she'd been tweeting little acerbic jokes to her 170 followers about her holiday travels. She was like a social media Sally Bowles, decadent and flighty and blissfully unaware that serious politics were looming. There was her joke about the German man on the plane from New York. "Weird German dude, you're in first class, it's 2014, get some deodorant, in a monologue as I inhale BO, thank God for pharmaceuticals." And then the layover at Heathrow. "Chili, cucumber sandwiches, bad teeth, back in London." And then the final leg. "Going to Africa, hope I don't get AIDS, just kidding, I'm white." She chuckled to herself, pressed send, and wandered around the airport for half an hour, sporadically checking Twitter. "I got nothing," she told me. "No replies." I imagined her feeling a bit deflated about this. That sad feeling when nobody congratulates you for being funny. That black silence when the internet doesn't talk back. She boarded the plane. It was an 11-hour flight. She slept. When it landed, she turned on her phone. Straight away there was a text from somebody she hadn't spoken to since high school. "I'm so sorry to see what's happening." She looked at it baffled. "And then my phone started to explode," she said. We were having this conversation 3 weeks later at her choice of location, the Cookshop restaurant in New York City. It was the very same restaurant where Michael had recounted to me the tale of Jonah's destruction. It was becoming for me the restaurant of stories of obliterated lives. But it was only a half coincidence. It was close to the building where they both worked. Michael had been offered a job at the Daily Beast as a result of his great Jonah scoop, and Justine had an office upstairs running the PR department for the magazine's publishers, IAC, who also owned Vimeo and OkCupid and Match.com. The reason why she wanted to meet me here and why she was wearing her expensive-looking work clothes was because at 6 p.m. she was due in there to clean out her desk. As she sat on the runway at Cape Town Airport, a second text popped up. "You need to call me immediately." It was from her best friend, Hannah. "You're the number one worldwide trend on Twitter right now." And so Justine looked at her timeline. "In light of at Justine Sacco's disgusting racist tweet, I'm donating to Care Today." And, "How did Justine Sacco get a PR job? Her level of racist ignorance belongs on Fox News. AIDS can affect anyone." And, "No words for that horribly disgusting, racist-as-fuck tweet from Justine Sacco. I am beyond horrified." And, "I'm an IAC employee, and I don't want Justine Sacco doing any communications on our behalf ever again. Ever." And, "Everyone go report this cunt Justine Sacco." And, from her employer's IAC, "This is an outrageous, offensive comment. Employee in question currently unreachable on an international flight." and fascinated by the Justine Sacco train wreck. It's global, and she's apparently still on the plane. And all I want for Christmas is to see Justine Sacco's face when her plane lands and she checks her inbox / voicemail. And, oh man, Justine Sacco is going to have the most painful phone turning on moment ever when her plane lands. A hashtag began trending worldwide. Hashtag, has Justine landed yet? Seriously, I just want to go home, to go to bed, but everyone at this bar is so into hashtag has Justine landed yet. Can't look away, can't leave. And it's kind of wild to see someone self-destruct without them even being aware of it. Hashtag has Justine landed yet. And hashtag has Justine landed yet may be the best thing to happen to my Friday night. Somebody worked out which flight she was on, and they linked to a flight tracker website so everyone could watch its progress in real time. Looks like Justine Sacco lands in about 9 minutes. This should be interesting. And we're about to watch this Justine Sacco bitch get fired in real time before she even knows she's getting fired. And, right, is there no one in Cape Town going to the airport to tweet her arrival? Come on, Twitter, I'd like pictures. Hashtag has Justine landed yet? And then, after she frantically deleted the tweet. Sorry, Justine Sacco, your tweet lives on forever. And so on, for a total of 100,000 tweets, according to calculations by the website BuzzFeed, until weeks later. Man, remember Justine Sacco? Hashtag has Justine landed yet? God, that was awesome. Millions of people waiting for her to land. I once asked a car crash victim what it had felt like to be in a smash-up. She said her eeriest memory was how 1 second the car was her friend, working for her, its contours designed to fit her body perfectly. Everything was smooth and sleek and luxurious, and then a blink of an eye later, it had become a jagged weapon of torture, like she was inside an Iron Maiden. Her friend had become her worst enemy. Over the years, I've sat across tables from a lot of people whose lives have been destroyed. Usually the people who did the destroying were the government, or the military, or big business, or, as with Jonah Lehrer, basically themselves, at least at first with Jonah. We took over as he tried to apologise. Justine Sacco felt like the first person I had ever interviewed who had been destroyed by us. Google has an engine, Google AdWords, that tells you how many times your name has been searched for during any given month. In October 2013, Justine was Googled 30 times. In November 2013, she was Googled 30 times. During the 11 days between the 20th of December and the end of December, she was Googled 1,220,000 times. A man had been waiting for her at Cape Town Airport. He was a Twitter user. He took her photograph and posted it online. Yep, he wrote, Justine Sacco has in fact landed at Cape Town International. She's decided to wear sunnies as a disguise. 3 weeks had passed since she pressed send on the tweet. The New York Post had been following her to the gym. Newspapers were ransacking her Twitter feed for more horrors. And the award for classiest tweet of all time goes to, I had a sex dream about an autistic kid last night, 4th of February 2012. 16 tweets Justine Sacco regrets, BuzzFeed, 20th of December 2013. This was the only time Justine would ever talk to a journalist about what happened to her, she told me. It was just too harrowing and inadvisable. As a publicist, I don't know that I would ever recommend to a client that they participate in your book. I'm very nervous about it. I'm really terrified about opening myself up to future attacks, but I think it's necessary. I want someone to just show how crazy my situation is. It was crazy because only an insane person would think that white people don't get AIDS. That was about the first thing she said to me when she sat down. To me, it was so insane a comment for an American to make. I thought there was no way that anyone could possibly think it was a literal statement. I know there are hateful people out there who don't like other people and are generally mean, but that's not me. Justine had been about 3 hours into her flight, probably asleep in the air over Spain or Algeria, when retweets of her tweet began to overwhelm my Twitter feed. After an initial happy little, "Oh wow, someone is fucked," I started to think her shamers must have been gripped by some kind of group madness or something. It seemed obvious that her tweet, whilst not a great joke, wasn't racist, but was a self-reflexive comment on white privilege, on our tendency to imagine ourselves immune to life's horrors, wasn't it? "It was a joke about a situation that exists," Justine said. "It was a joke about a dire situation that does exist in post-apartheid South Africa that we don't pay attention to. It was completely outrageous commentary on the disproportionate AIDS statistics. Unfortunately, I am not a character on South Park or a comedian, so I had no business commenting on the epidemic in such a politically incorrect manner on a public platform. To put it simply, I wasn't trying to raise awareness of AIDS, or piss off the world, or ruin my life. Living in America puts us in a bit of a bubble when it comes to what's going on in the third world. I was making fun of that bubble." As it happens, I once made a similar, albeit funnier, joke in a column for The Guardian. It was about a time I flew into the United States and was sent for secondary processing. There was a mafioso hitman on the run at the time with a name that apparently sounded quite a lot like John Ronson. I was taken into a packed holding room and told to wait. There were signs everywhere saying the use of cell phones is strictly prohibited. "I'm sure they won't mind me checking my text messages, I think. I mean, after all, I am white." My joke was funnier than Justine's joke. It was better worded. Plus, as it didn't invoke AIDS sufferers, it was less unpleasant. So, mine was funnier, better worded, and less unpleasant. But it suddenly felt like that Russian roulette scene in The Deer Hunter, when Christopher Walken puts the gun to his head and lets out a scream and pulls the trigger and the gun doesn't go off. It was to a large extent Justine's own fault that so many people thought she was a racist. Her self-reflexive sarcasm had been badly worded, her wider Twitter persona quite brittle, but I hadn't needed to think about her tweet for more than a few seconds before I understood what she'd been trying to say. There must have been amongst her shamers a lot of people who chose to willfully misunderstand it, for some reason. "I can't fully grasp the misconception that's happening around the world," Justine said. "They've taken my name and my picture and have created this Justine Sacco that's not me and have labelled this person a racist. I have this fear that if I was in a car accident tomorrow and lost my memory and came back and Googled myself, that would be my new reality." I suddenly remembered how weirdly tarnished I felt when the Spambot men created their fake John Ronson, getting my character traits all wrong, turning me into some horrific garrulous foodie, and strangers believed it was me and there was nothing I could do. That's what was happening to Justine, although instead of a foodie, she was a racist, and instead of 50 people, it was 1,220,000. Journalists are supposed to be intrepid. We're supposed to stand tall in the face of injustice and not fear crazy mobs. But neither Justine nor I saw much fearlessness in how her story was reported. Even articles about how we could all be minutes away from having a Justine Sacco moment were all couched in, "I am no way defending what she said," she told me. As vile as the sentiment she expressed was, there were some potential extenuating circumstances here that don't excuse her behaviour but might mitigate her misdeed somewhat. Repugnant as her joke was, there is a difference between outright hate speech and even the most ill-advised attempt at humour. Andrew Wallenstein, Sympathy for this Twitter Devil, Variety, 22nd of December 2013. Andrew Wallenstein was braver than most, but still, it read like the old media saying to social media, "Don't hurt me." Justine released an apology statement.